We're talking about, this one's titled Love, Hate, and Bigotry, which is basically me just stringing three words together so I could then talk about whatever I wanted. Preachers do that sort of thing. We just go, oh, that title'll be close enough, and then I'll just kind of wing it from there. What we are going to look at is the fact that there is a problem in the culture that you live in, that people think that if you disagree with somebody, you must hate them. And that if you're intolerant of behavior, that means you're also intolerant of them. That's what bigotry is where you are somebody who is considered irrationally intolerant. That is, I just don't like you because you're not like me. Maybe your skin color is different. Maybe your culture is different. And I found something about you and your beliefs that's different, and so I just don't like you. You're not important to me. And it is often said that Christians are bigoted. We're full of hate. And I know that's not true, and you know that's not true. But we kind of have to prove our point sometimes, because everybody's saying that the Bible is a hateful book, and intolerant, judgmental people follow it. So we just have to make sure that we prove them wrong. That's another part of your job. So you kind of have this uphill battle with these social skills because everybody has already decided a lot of times what they think you are the moment you say, I'm a Christian. Or the moment you say, I believe in God. Or the moment you walk into a room carrying a Bible. There's a lot of people who will judge you immediately and assume that you are judging them immediately. And so we have to go and unlearn you must, says Yoda. We've got to do that. We've got to teach them that that's not the case. Because there are some things that I hate, but people is not one of them. In fact, I'll give you an example of what hate is. I used to work at a zoo. And at the zoo, people think working at a zoo is this very glamorous, exciting job where, you know, you ride the leopards around for fun on your lunch break. And that's not at all what you do. Let me explain to you what a zookeeper is. You are the person who cleans up after the animals so that everybody else can look at the animals. I didn't get to do that. I didn't get to look at the animals. I had to clean up where the animals weren't anymore. And so it's pretty much a thankless job. And they don't pay you a whole lot. And I was, of zookeepers, I was the bottom of the totem pole. So I got every job that nobody else wanted to do. So there was a bat cave. That's right. I was in the bat cave. And I had to go in and clean it. Now, cleaning a bat cave is not as exciting as what you would think it is. You go in there and the fruit bats are all flying around you, flapping in your face and everything like that. And you go in with a hose and you clean off the walls. And yes, it smells horrific. But that was not the worst job. I didn't mind that job that much. In fact, I did that job with a guy who had a beard and he would sometimes come out with bats hanging from his beard. And that was hilarious. The worst job was with walking sticks. Walking sticks are a bug that they get about this long, and they have big, long, skinny, articulated little arms, and they kind of move like a praying mantis moves with that kind of slow, creepy sort of look. And they look like a stick, just a green stick about this big, so that they'll blend in and not get eaten. Well, we had a case about this big, that deep, full of them, and there were a couple of branches in there that they would climb on. And every 6 months, you have to clean up after bugs, too. And so there were roughly, I'd say, 300-400 walking sticks in there, in that space. So you have to clean out all of the bark and everything underneath. And nobody wanted to do it, so it became my job. And you know how you clean it out? You don't take the walking sticks out. You stick your head in. And your head's in that box. And that's the only way to get in. You got to get in there and you start pulling all the things out. And the whole time that you're doing that, the walking sticks are crawling up your neck over your head. I hate walking sticks. I can tell you that from the top of my head to the tips of my toes, I hate them. I see pictures of them, National Geographic, and I tense up immediately. I feel them right now. Right now, as I tell this story, I can feel them on my... That's hate. It is such a deep revulsion of everything about them. I don't hate what walking sticks do. I don't hate what they look like or what they sound like. I hate them. Everything about them to their very core. That's what hate is. And the culture you live in says that's what you do. When you disagree with somebody's choices in life, when you see somebody sinning, you must have that kind of revulsion for them. That's not true. But that's what they have in their mind. And that's why people sometimes think that Christians are arrogant. Well, you just look down on people. Because, you know, I do look down on walking sticks. If I saw a walking stick right now, I would kill it immediately. With no regret or pity in my eye. And people assume if you hate me, you'd be happy to get rid of me. I don't matter to you. You look down on me. You know, that's not what Christians do. In Matthew chapter 9, there's a story with Jesus. It says, now it happened as Jesus sat at the table in the house, behold, many tax collectors and sinners came and sat down with him and his disciples. And when the Pharisees saw it, they said to his disciples, why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? And when Jesus heard that, he said to them, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. But go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice, for I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. I want you to take this verse, and we're going to talk about it. And I'm going to give you some details about it. There's a lot in here. It's a dynamite stick of power in these set of verses. But the next time somebody accuses you of being judgmental, or Christianity of being judgmental, this is the verse I want you to simply say, have you ever read Matthew 9, verse 10? I want you to point them to this. Because it's very funny. When Jesus lived, he sat down at a table with a bunch of people who were sinners. That's what it says, tax collectors and sinners. And he was accused by the Pharisees of being what? Being too loose. Why would you sit down with these people? Why would you eat with these people? Don't you know they have problems? Don't you know they're bad people? Why would you do that? Jesus is actually the opposite of what people accuse Christianity of. And that's what we're supposed to be. And it's shocking to the world, by the way, when you are that way. Because in Matthew 9, verses 10 through 13, there are several different things that those verses prove. One, Jesus sat down with these people, and he was open about his judgment of their behavior. Jesus never pretended they didn't have problems. He sat down with tax collectors and sinners, and when he was accused, and they said, don't you know who you're sitting with? He said, yeah, I do. I do know. They're people with problems. He never hid the fact that there was a right and a wrong. He didn't compromise his beliefs. Two, it proves that you can sit down and be friendly with people without doing the same things as them or endorsing their behavior. I can be friendly with somebody and nice with somebody without doing the exact same things they do. Just simply because they're a human being. And so that's another thing that people don't always realize, is that it is possible for a Christian to be friends with plenty of people who believe all sorts of different things other than them. I have friends and family members who are all sorts of things. I have family members that are alcoholics. And I sit down and I eat meals with them. I don't sit down and drink with them. But I sit around the table with them. I have family members that believe aborting babies is okay. And talk openly about how they think everybody should be able to abort a child. And yet I still talk to them. I have multiple family members and some friends who are homosexual. And you know what? I can sit down and eat with them. Without in any way endorsing their behavior or their ideas, I can still sit down with them as human beings. And the reason I know I can, and I do my best to do that, is because that's what Jesus did. The third thing is, a disagreement with someone's lifestyle is not the same as hatred of them. I can disagree with choices somebody else is making without hating them as a human being. Now, all these things we're going to talk about in more detail. But each of them is powerful in and of themselves. Okay, there we go. And then the fourth thing is, it is important for you and I to engage in positive disagreement with people. Remember how in the lesson this morning I talked about conflict, and conflict is okay? Make sure and surround yourself with people who don't always agree with you on everything. That's good for you. Make sure to not be like Rehoboam, who only has people who are his buddies who think exactly like them. Conflict is part of what makes us better people. Surround yourself with Christians, with people who have the same values as you that will challenge you. If it's healthy for you to have people to challenge you, do you know what is also healthy? For you to challenge people. People need you to be in their life to challenge their beliefs. What happens to the atheist who's been raised and told there is no God? Their parents never went to church anywhere. There was never a Bible around the house. They go to school, and what is the school system with the science classes? What are they going to get there? Science classes tell you, where'd you come from? Evolution, that's right. You came from goo. It's goo to you. Molecules to man. Boom, you came from nothing. You're an accidental oops. That's what they're going to get in school. So mom and dad didn't tell them any different. They didn't have a Bible around to read any different. They go to school and they don't hear any different. And they don't just hear it in the science classes. They're going to hear it in the history classes too. I don't know if any of you have taken some college history or sociology classes. But they will tell you quite clearly where you came from. Cavemen. Ugh. And man has moved from a hunter-gatherer society to now we have Stanford. So you're going to get in all your classes. And so you have somebody, and their whole life they have been told, there's no God, don't worry about God, just live for yourself. What do you think they're going to believe if nobody ever challenges that or makes them question that? They're going to die an atheist. They need you. They need you to challenge their beliefs. They need you to question and make them question what they believe. You can't force somebody to change, but you can at least give them an opportunity to think about it. So that's a healthy part of what we do. When Jesus sat down with these people, he didn't sit down so that they could just continue what they were doing. He sat down and he talked with them to provide an alternative option. You're going to run into people in your life, if you haven't run into already, who are just really not super happy. Any of you go to school with or know somebody who comes from a family that you would consider very dysfunctional? Anybody know somebody who has a very dysfunctional family? Family is not happy. Mom and dad don't get along, or mom and dad aren't married, or everybody argues. Yeah, okay. I'll keep my hand raised because my family was dysfunctional. A lot of us do. Most of us do. The reality is in America, the divorce rate is no longer at 50%. It's a little bit less than 50%. So that means a little less than half of the kids that you know and your peers will come from a divorced family, which is not the way God designed it. So, and maybe some of you are dealing with the aftermath of that sort of thing. My parents were divorced, and that's not a fun way to grow up. When people are surrounded by problems and unhealthy lifestyles, I'll tell you what, they don't know what they don't know. When I was growing up, Christmas was where everybody got together and the grown-ups got drunk and the kids went upstairs and tried to play games and stuff and we didn't understand why the grown-ups were acting so strangely. It wasn't until I was older I figured out, oh, that's what alcohol does. That was Christmas. And then the next day, we would get up to open the stockings and everything, and our parents did not want to get up because they had something called a hangover. That's what I thought Christmas was. That's what I thought all holidays were. That was my entire reality. It was not until I met my wife and we started our own family and tried to do it the Bible way and I started meeting Christians that I realized that's not the way the holidays are for everybody. That was shocking to me. I'd never had anybody challenge that I had another option. That's what you and I can do. We can provide for people an opportunity. It doesn't have to be that way. There are alternatives. And they need that. They need somebody to provide an alternative so that if they want to choose it, they can. Can you make anybody a Christian? No. If you could, I'd just start grabbing people and shoving them under the water. I'd just mug people on the street. Come with me. That doesn't work that way, does it? It has to be a free will decision. But you can show them, hey, over here's this, if you're interested. But you can't do that if you're not around them. So one of the things that we have to work on is being in a world that thinks we're hateful and showing them that's not true. So, number one, if we're going to do that, we can't water down the truth. Here's what I mean by water down the truth. Anybody ever made Kool-Aid? Okay. Kool-Aid's not really the big one now. Is it like Crystal Light? Is that more common now? Is anybody actually... some people still make Kool-Aid. When you make Kool-Aid, you got the little packet. And then you have water. If you add too much water, what happens to the taste of the Kool-Aid? Not enough cool and sugar. And it's not any good. If you and I water down the message of Christianity to be friendly with people, do we do them any good? There's not enough to make a difference. Now you're just being like them. You're compromising your morals to make them more comfortable, and that doesn't help. When Jesus sat down with the tax collectors and sinners, in Matthew 9, verse 13, he says, I did not come to call the righteous but sinners to repentance. I want you to imagine for a second, Jesus is sitting at this table with all of these people, and they're eating, and they're asking him questions, and trying to... He's a big, important teacher. He's kind of famous at this time. And so Matthew's had him over the house, he has all of these people here, and then the Pharisees, they come in and they ask, why is he sitting with them? And Jesus says, I didn't come to call the righteous, but sinners. What did he just say about all the people at the table? You're a bunch of sinners. He never watered down the truth. Everybody knew where he stood. And that's important. It's going to be very important for the people that you know in your life who drink to know you don't. It's going to be very important for the people that you meet in life who swear and cuss and use foul language that you don't. They've got to see the difference, otherwise you make no difference with them. So that's the first thing is, don't ever consider that being a Christian who spends time with people who aren't Christians means that you hide your Christianity. In Mark chapter 12, down to verse 14, Jesus' enemies came up to him one day and they said, "Teacher, we know that you're true and you do not care about anyone's opinion, for you are not swayed by appearances, but truly teach the way of God." Jesus' enemies came up and addressed him one day and they said, "You know what? We know one thing about you, Jesus. You don't care about appearances. You're just going to teach it to us straight." People need to know that about you if you're going to make a difference with them. They need to know that you're a straight shooter, that you're the kind of person doesn't water down the thing, but most people will respect you for that. We all have these people in our lives that we know will be the ones who tell us if there's something wrong. You're sitting around after lunch and some of the us adults were talking about that person that will tell you if you got some food in your teeth. You want to know who your real friend is? They don't want to say, "Hey, you look like a goober. You got something in your teeth." That's your real friend, right? They're the one who'll say it. They won't ignore it. They go, "Hey, do you know you got toilet paper off the back of your shoe? You look like an idiot." They're your real friends. They're the ones who are going to try and save you from lifelong embarrassment by pointing it out. The rest of the people were just, "Well, we're not going to say anything about it." They were more concerned with being embarrassed by saying something than your embarrassment by not having anything said to you. Your real friends will say something. And you respect that, don't you? We like people we can trust will tell us the truth. Yes, that just does not make you look the way you want to look. That shirt is ridiculous. It's from 7th grade and you're 35. I may have had somebody say that to me once. We need these people in our life. And we need to be these kind of people. And what we find is that honest people, which are the only people you're ever going to make a difference with anyway, are you going to ever lead a dishonest person to Jesus? Dishonest people don't become Christians, do they? No. So don't worry about what a dishonest person would think of you. Honest people, they're the only ones you're going to ever make an impact with. Honest people respect honesty. So be honest about your opinion and honest about what you believe about them. Proverbs 20, verse 6 says, "Most men will proclaim everyone his own kindness, but a faithful man who can find." Anybody can compliment people to their face, but it takes an honest person. This verse we already looked at, I think, this morning. "Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are profuse." I lost my connection. Click on the bottom. Oh, yep, airplane mirroring. How long ago did I lose it? Oh, just a second ago, okay. Yeah. "Faithful are the wounds of a friend." Those of you who said, "Hey, Scott, you're talking with a blank screen." Thank you. Yeah, see? So, it is important in life to be a straight shooter. Do not be afraid to be honest about the fact that there are things that you consider sin and will not practice. You just have to be honest about that. If people ask why you don't do certain things or why you do certain things, just say, "It's a matter of religious conviction. I do it because I believe that's the kind of person God wants me to be." If you haven't had it happen yet, you will eventually have somebody who has chosen a homosexual lifestyle ask you, "Do you believe it's wrong to be a homosexual?" You're going to get that question. If you haven't gotten it yet, you're going to get that question. When you're asked that question, no matter what you say, somewhere in there, it has to be, "Yes, I think it's a sin." Now, you can word it a lot of different ways, but ultimately, you're going to have to somewhere in there say, "Yes, I believe it's a sin." And that's going to be hard. Because in today's culture, somebody who says that is considered hateful. But you've got to be a straight shooter. You can't make any difference by hiding it. You have to be honest about it. Number two, you can sit down with people without emulating or endorsing their lifestyles. Jesus ate with tax collectors and sinners. Do not be afraid to be kind to people who are not Christians and to spend time with them. Now, everybody has an inner circle of friends and people they're close to, and then people who are not as close to them. They're on a little further out in terms of intimacy. Even Jesus. Jesus had an inner circle. Peter, James, and John were his closest, even amongst the apostles. So we all have layers of friendship. Don't make your closest friends be non-Christians. I will caution you against that. That's what 1 Corinthians 15:33 is talking about when it says bad company corrupts good morals. Make sure that the people who are closest to you, the people that you lean on when you are struggling, when you're hurting, are people who have the right kind of morals and guidance. Make sure that's your inner core. But we all also have a plethora of people that we're friends with that aren't at that inner closest level. And Jesus was friendly with lots of people. And he let lots of people lean on him. Lots of people who turn to him for help and support. And we need to be that way. Do not be afraid to be friendly and helpful to people who are not Christians. In 1 Corinthians chapter 5, down in verse 10, Paul actually warned the church. He says, not at all meaning the sexually immoral of this world, or the greedy and swindlers or idolaters, since then you would need to go out of the world. Paul, in 1 Corinthians 5, was talking to the church about discipline and how there is a time where a Christian needs to be disciplined because their life, they're no longer living the kind of life that God intended. And he says, yeah, if you have somebody in the church that's a drunkard, we got to do something about that. But on the other hand, if you're not going to do anything with anybody in the world who has sin in their life, well, you're going to have a problem, aren't you? Because how many people outside of Christ have sin problems? As far as I know, every single one of them. And the only reason you don't have a sin problem is because why? Is it because you don't sin anymore? No, it's because you've been forgiven. That's the only difference. And it is a big difference. It's a heaven-hell difference. But do not in any way think that you and I are supposed to just say, oh, those worldly people without God, I cannot do anything with them. If that's the case, stop going to the grocery store. Stop driving out in the middle of traffic. Stop going to school. Because you're going to have to cut yourself off from every other human being. Head for the mountains and become a hermit. But that's not what we're supposed to do. What we're supposed to do is actually be involved in the lives of people who aren't Christians. And be somebody that they can lean on. In Romans chapter 12, down to verses 18 through 21, in Romans it says, if possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. If your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. For by so doing, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. We're not just told to be nice to people in the world who don't have God. We're supposed to take people who are out in the world who hate us. Which not everybody out there hates you. But even the ones who are your enemy, you keep helping them out. You be nice to them. Now, this may not be the case for you, but I remember when I was in high school, I had one guy in high school who hated my guts. He just didn't like me. He was the kind of person that if we were passing by in the hallway, he would purposely stick out his shoulder so that he could whack me in the shoulder. And me being a really good, nice person, you know what I did? Whenever I saw him, I stuck my shoulder out and I did the same thing. We just despised each other. And then I became a Christian, And there became a problem for me. Because that relationship could no longer be the way it was. What does God call us to do with those people that we have just a very strong, bitter relationship with? They don't like us. And I can tell you, I have no idea why the guy didn't like me. I mean, I'm sure there was something somewhere in there. But it was so long ago, I couldn't even remember it. What are we called to do? What does that verse say we're called to do? Well, we're called to be like Jesus. We're called to overcome the evil with good. If he needed help with his homework, I should have helped him with it. The fact is, I should have been looking in his life to see what is it that's going on that is making him so unhappy, and how can I fix it? That's the kind of people we're called to be. We're called to be as involved with people in this world as possible, while still being us, right? Don't let them change you. And if you find that there's a relationship that you have with somebody who is not a Christian that's changing who you are, what should you do then? If you're finding you're compromising your morals because of that relationship, what do you do? If there's somebody out there in the world, there's somebody that you have a friendship with, and you find that they are pulling you away from God, who do you choose, God or them? You always choose God. But there's lots of people that you're going to have an opportunity to influence that won't pull you away from God, but instead you can pull them towards God, and you can offer them that alternative. In Matthew chapter 9, Jesus explains what our relationship is with every other human being. He says, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. He uses an analogy. Now, you go to a doctor. Why does somebody become a doctor? Every doctor that I know, at some point, chose to become a doctor because why? They wanted to help people feel better because they don't like being sick. That's right. Every doctor I know, in fact, every person that I know of in a servant sort of role says, I got into this because I wanted to help people. I wanted to make a difference. So a doctor, they go through all that schooling so that they could help people. Now you go to the doctor and they spend their whole job trying to get rid of sickness because they hate people. No. Why do doctors work so hard to get rid of cancer? Because they don't want people dying. Because they love people. You can understand that analogy, can't you? Doctors love people who are sick, but hate sickness. Does that make sense? Nod your head if it makes sense. Okay. That's the analogy Jesus uses to talk about sin. The reality is that sin is no different. Christians hate sin. And in that, you're allowed to hate. So, if somebody ever says, you're just hateful, you say, yes, I am. I am very hateful. I hate sin. Do you know why you hate sin? What does sin do to people? Sin is the number one cause of eternal destruction. Why do people go to hell? There's only one reason, right? And when you don't follow God's rules, what do we call that? What's the word? If somebody broke one of God's rules, what do we say? They sin. Christians hate sin because we know what it does to people. The same way doctors hate cancer because they know what it does to people. So you are allowed to hate. Kind of a funny thing to say, isn't it? How often do you hear a preacher say, it's okay to hate? It is. It's okay to hate. It's never okay to hate people. But you and I absolutely should hate sin because of what it does to people. it's possible for you to look at somebody's actions, what they're doing, and say, that's wrong because you care about their soul. I have a whole family of alcoholics who drink a lot. I hate alcoholism. I hate alcohol. Tell you why. Because I see what it does to people. It destroys their life. I love people. I love my family. I hate what that has done to them. It is a sickness. It is destroying them. And can we say that about any sort of sin? You name a sin that makes your life better. Even if you think it makes it better in the short term, it always in the long run makes it worse. So it's okay to hate because we hate what it's doing to people. And that's our job. Our job is to get people to see that. Yeah, I disagree with you about this and that because I'm afraid of what's going to happen to you because of that. The last thing we said is having that disagreement with people is necessary, right? Why is it so important? Why is it important that you and I disagree with people and tell them that we think what they're doing is wrong? Why is that important? I'm going to give you a scenario. We leave this building and there's big, busy street out front. Market Street, right? Big, busy street. So imagine you see one of the little kids running out into traffic. And so they're just headed straight out into the traffic, not looking where they're going, and they're just making a beeline for it. Would it be loving to yell stop? Would it be hateful to not say anything? I think it would. Can you imagine? Yeah, I saw the kid running. I said, well, he'll figure it out. What would you think of me if I did it? Yeah, I saw him running out of traffic. I said, well, I'll just see how this plays out. That's hateful, isn't it? That's a disregard for human life. If I didn't say, or you didn't say, stop! You'd say, there's no love in that person's heart. They don't care about other human beings. But when you say stop, you're disagreeing with the action of that child, aren't you? Stop is you saying, what you're doing is wrong. If people are living lives that are taking them away from God, what's the loving thing to do? You got to say stop, don't you? You got to say it somehow. You got to try whenever you can because that's what we came here to do, is to save souls. It's about love. It's not about hate. When you say something's a sin, it's not because you hate the person. It's because you love the person. I don't want you running out into traffic. And by the way, I want that to also give you some courage. Because most of the time we don't yell at people, do we? But if you saw how in danger a child was, if you saw a car barreling down the road, and the child about to run into traffic, would you raise your voice? Would you have the courage to raise your voice? You'd find it all of a sudden from deep down in your gut. Stop! You'd find it because you saw how dangerous it was. Those times when you don't want to say something to anybody, when it's scary to stand up for what you believe in, it's scary to disagree with the crowd, I want you to be brave by thinking about that truck going to hit a kid. Because it's the same thing. Somebody's got to stand up and say, no, no, this isn't the way it's supposed to be. This isn't what God wants. This isn't the way your life is supposed to turn out. In 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 15, it says, the saying is trustworthy and deserving of full acceptance that Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am the foremost. But I received mercy for this reason, that in me, as the foremost, Jesus Christ might display his perfect patience as an example to those who were to believe in him for eternal life. One of the problems is, with that car analogy, kid running out of traffic, how many times do I yell stop? I'm probably only going to yell it one time, because that's the only shot I got, right? But in your normal everyday life, how many times do you end up disagreeing with people because of what you believe in? Probably more than once. It's going to come up over and over and over and over and over again. And you know what Paul said? I receive mercy for this reason, that in me, as the foremost, Jesus Christ might display his perfect patience to continue to stand up for your beliefs, continue to say, I believe in the Bible, I think there's a right and there's a wrong, is going to take some patience. Because you don't just do it once, you do it over and over and over and over again. And the other piece of that puzzle is you do it over and over and over again, because who's going to listen? Could you tell me of the, say, 500 people that you will meet in the next year, which one of them is going to listen? Do you know? Tell you what, I don't know. There's no way to know. You just got to be patient and keep at it. Keep living your life, and people will notice. Some people will listen. Some people won't. Some people will change. Some people won't. But you just remember, it's an act of love to do that. It's an act of love to continue to stand by what you believe. Because what you believe is not about you. It's not about saying, look at how great I am. It's about, just like Paul said, Christ came in the world to save sinners. And then what did Paul say he was? He says, I am the foremost of sinners. It's not about how great we are. It's about how great our God is. Luke 11, verse 33 says, no one, after lighting a lamp, puts it in a cellar or under a basket, but on a stand, so that those who enter may see the light. Once you ask yourself the question, are you putting your light on a stand? Are you doing things that give you an opportunity to make a difference and make an impact in the world around you? We got a whole span of age here. So it's going to look different for everybody. But you do have to look at it and say, are there people in my life that I am trying to make a difference with and let my light shine? Because if you're not, then we're not doing our job. Because we're to be people who are living a Christ-like life in a world that needs that. And so the two go together. Okay. We got time. I'm over this time. Okay. Well, I think, where are we at on the schedule? What's the next thing on the books? Okay. I will pass it over to Richard here. Thank you guys so very much for your time. Go right ahead and stand up and stretch for half a second.